Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, and Monterey.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey, for getting us on the show one more time. I think we're up to like 185 or 86. Can you believe that? It's been a long time, and we've done them from various parts of the country and several from Romania, I believe. Okay, well, Mike, would you put that steel bow down? It's time to broadcast. I got Mike into the steel bow flexor isometric exercise thing, and he won't lay the thing down. Wonderful little device, though. You can do a full isometric workout in about a minute and a half, and you can actually feel it, and some say you can see it. But welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that wonderful trip he takes us on every week across the United States, where he sings from memory without aid, the lyrics that take us across 90 cities and states. Isn't that incredible? Thank you very much, Emily and Mike, for joining us tonight. We're just kidding you, Mike. Go ahead and work out. We can't hear it. It's almost silent anyway. The purpose of our show is what it is every week. We try to discuss news issues, events, and developments in this difficult and always humorous field of criminal justice. And I want to give you advance warning tonight. I swear to God, this is mainline news. I didn't have to go search for this. But you're going to think that some of these news stories we started with tonight came from another planet. They don't. They're from the planet Earth, and for the most part, they're from the United States. A couple are overseas stories, but not all of them. But you talk about wacky. This has been a really crazy week, and what some of these cities are doing, the federal government is just absolutely incredible. And we'll get to that in a moment. The show is dedicated to our energetic, tireless police courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals. Tonight we're going to do another book, and this is going to be a different take for you. You know, Haley's done more than one show on illegal immigration, and we have guests from the Border Patrol. We're going to have one who spent his whole career and wrote his doctoral dissertation about stopping illegal immigration in the month of July, after July 8th, and that'll be a really nice presentation to hear live. But tonight we're going to talk about stopping legal and illegal immigration. Did you hear what I said? Legal and illegal immigration, and the gentleman has an entire book about it, Mr. Krikorian, and we'll let him tell you about that here in just a while. A very interesting thesis, and he's saying we can't take any more people. And his point number one is we don't have an economy anymore to bring in all of these unskilled workers, whether they're legal or illegal, and we can't train them and prep them for jobs that we don't have and will not have. Technology's been part of that change and caused that, but it'll be interesting to hear him present his thesis. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network. It's leading edge technology as always. Alan Levy's the CEO. Levy is the CEO of PTR. He's the genius behind the medium, as I'm fond of saying, and Blog Talk Radio is one of the top 100 websites in the world. If you look on the website, you'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of radio shows. Many more of their segments archived that are on demand that you can either download for yourself or play and listen on virtually any subject imaginable. I forget how many categories they have each week. I think it's 66 categories now, the sports, religion, politics, conservative, liberal, on and on and on. So anyway, take a look at all those things. It's a good way to spend some of your time. What's possible? You, any person, any interest group, any outfit you belong to, you can have your own radio show. You can broadcast live and streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it doesn't cost you one penny. It costs you a phone call. I'm broadcasting, as I always do, from a cell phone. That means you can broadcast from, you know, a motorboat, from your canoe, your kayak, maybe not on your motorcycle, especially if it's a Harley, it'd be a little too loud. But anyway, you get the idea. Absolutely free. Somebody would have told you this 10 years ago, they would have locked you up thinking that you were crazy. But that's what Alan Levy has provided for all of us. These shows are archived immediately for replay. They can be downloaded in MP3 format, whatever. So get your own show if you can't find one that you like. Tonight's show, like I said, we're going to be talking about legal and illegal immigration, and we'll get to the introduction of that in just a while. If you're listening on your computer, you can call into the show during the news segment if you'd like to do that. The call-in number is 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983. Should you ever need to do it, we've done it before. We can hold five calls at the same time, and we can all talk to each other. Another miracle of that technology. Well, Audrey, you have a bond joke for us tonight. I understand this is, you're saying this is the shortest one, that we could count the number of words on two hands. Is that right? Well, maybe not that short, but I took a sneak peek of this one ahead of time, and I really like it. It's about a blonde interviewing for a job. In case you would be joining us for the first time, that happens once in a while. Audrey England is a blonde who grew up in London, England, and she's been a collector of blonde jokes since she was a small girl, and she has trunks full of them, and she's found one tonight for us that is brief but indeed funny. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, this may indeed be our shortest blonde joke ever, but I think our listeners will like it. The blonde lady gives the best answer she could to the person interviewing her for a job. Here it is. The executive was interviewing a young blonde for a position in his company. He wanted to find out something about her personality, so he asked, if you could have a conversation with someone, living or dead, who would it be? The blonde quickly responded, the living one.
That is a quick one, but that is a funny one. On a much more serious note, ladies and gentlemen, there is still crime in America, although we're enjoying the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years. And the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms is trying to get the criminals to turn in their firearms. If they hear this public service announcement, I'm sure some criminals are listening to our radio show tonight. I've had some on that for guests. But if they're listening tonight, we hope they will heed the message. Take their firearms down to the police or sheriff's department and turn them in. If it requires a buyback and a gift card, that's okay too, but let's get these guns off the street. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is Ohio Coalition. We want to thank you for that ever-present public service announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to depart from tonight on our green tip. And you remember, we need to save the planet and limit your CO2 emissions. So we usually have been taking our green tip for the last several months at least from Esma Floyd's fine little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. But tonight we're not going to do that. We're going to take an actual news story that I'm still trying to figure out. Maybe you can help me with part of this one. In order to cool the planet and conserve energy, the Japanese government has told people to go to bed an hour early to cut carbon emissions. I'm not kidding. They're urged to go to bed 1 hour earlier than normal in order to tackle climate change. Here's their thinking. Japanese government has launched a campaign encouraging people to go to bed and get up extra early in order to reduce household carbon dioxide emissions. The Morning Challenge campaign unveiled by the Environment Ministry, is based on the premise that swapping late-night electricity for an extra hour of morning sunlight could significantly cut the nation's carbon footprint. A typical family can reduce its carbon footprint by 85 kilograms a year if everyone goes to bed and gets up 1 hour earlier, according to the campaign. I wonder how they know that. I've always wondered who's keeping the big calculator in the sky that keeps track of all this. But anyway, the amount of carbon dioxide emissions potentially saved from going to bed an hour early was the equivalent of 20% of annual emissions from household lights. Can you believe that? Many Japanese people, it says, waste electric power at night. Do you know how they do it? It says in the article that they waste electric power at night by watching television until very late, and they really should stop that. But going to bed early and getting up early can avoid wasting electrical power, which causes carbon dioxide emissions. If people change their lifestyle, we can save energy and reduce emissions, they're saying. And people can take advantage of that extra hour in the morning sunlight by improving their lifestyles in general by, says they can run, run. That would use more. That would release more CO2, wouldn't it? Well, I don't know. Doing yoga and eating a nutritious breakfast. I'm sure the government is probably planning what that breakfast is going to be. But Japan's under an order here to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions by 25%. From 1990, and they have to do that within the next decade. So there we are. It was the same government that launched the high-profile Cool Biz campaign 5 years ago, which encouraged workers to wear short-sleeve shirts and offices not to turn their air conditioning lower than 28 degrees during the summer. That's not our Fahrenheit, 28 degrees, but anyway. There you are, and there sits Mike tonight. Mike, in your long sleeve shirt, and you probably have the air conditioning turned up a couple of notches because of that. But anyway, that's the Japanese government doing that. Let's move on to our news. And if you think the Japanese story is a little odd, listen to some of these, and I think you will think this indeed came from another planet. Here's the story of a city in California, a town, a village, whatever they call it. And this little village has decided to do something. And as I get this story up, we'll talk about it. Maywood, California, will lay off all of its city employees and begin contracting police services with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. That's not unusual in California. The L.A. County Sheriff's Department delivers police services on a contract basis to lots and lots of places. In other words, they get special police services, not just the regular services you would get from living in the county. In addition to contracting with the Sheriff's Department, the Maywood City Council voted unanimously Monday night to lay off an estimated 100 employees and contract with the neighboring city of Bell, California, which will handle other city services such as finance, records management, parks and recreation, street maintenance, and some others. Certainly, they wouldn't give away their water maintenance. Well, it's important as water is. But anyway, Maywood will be billed $50,000 a month which officials say will save them $164,375 annually. But what's a $376? No, get my point. We will become 100% a contracted city, says Angela Spaccia, Mayward's interim city manager. Deputies from the East Los Angeles Sheriff's Department station will begin patrolling this 1.2 square mile area. Could be a very big place. And in fact, how many people live in this place? Here, I don't have the, should have looked up that demographic data. Here they give us race and ethnicity. It says it's 96.4% Latino, 2.8% white, and 0.8% of other. Foreign-born is 48.6%. Families below poverty level, 19. A little bit of demographic data there. At a council meeting, they decided to do this. It says, we're limited in our choices, says Councilman Felipe Aguirre, told the standing room only crowd. Frustrated and enraged residents blame the council for the city's predicament. No, you couldn't blame them. And for not following an insurance company's recommendation, which council members had agreed to last year. The recommendation included hiring a permanent city manager. I'm wondering why we even need the city. I mean, people could continue to live and get reasonable services and that type of thing. But anyway, they're trying to keep this city alive by contracting everything out to some other place. Does that sound a little bit odd to you? I thought you would enjoy that story. We'll try to keep you posted on what happens to Maywood, California. Oh, there's the population. I'm sorry. It's 27,000 people. 27,911. That's bigger than the town I'm broadcasting from. So that is just amazing. They can't keep it going. I wonder when they figured out they were out of money. I always question that. Here's another one. You know, Elena Kagan is a nominee for the United States Supreme Court, and that little battle is heating up, as it always does, for nominated Supreme Court justices or nominees for Supreme Court justice. And one of the things that they have found out, which is just incredible, you can go to a site called Sunlight Foundation, or you can go directly to a link, and this is out of a New York Times story, called Elena's Inbox. And this is a complete listing. It looks exactly, if you've got Gmail, I've been there. It looks exactly like your Gmail inbox, where it goes down certain pages, then it goes older and older. You go to more and more. You can get thousands of email messages. It's about 5,000 emails that she sent over a period of 5 years. You can read every word of them. And you can actually do a search on them, just like you can in Google's Gmail. So the article says that some of them are amusing, others are enlightening, others still are both. But there's some text in there about things that could be problematic for. I won't go over some of those, but isn't that amazing that the Sunlight Foundation has been able to find this information? Because it is public records, and before, nobody could make sense out of that. I mean, it was just thrown up on some type of archive somewhere, and who knows how to search it or whatever. But the Sunlight Foundation has made this work just like your Gmail inbox. I think that is just absolutely fascinating. What a deal. And for somebody that's researching, for example, Clinton administration policies on crime or whatever it might be, content analysis of those email studies would be very interesting. This one, are you holding onto your seat? You probably heard about this when it's gone all over the place, but prison inmates are getting the home buyer tax credit, according to a government report. Nearly 1,300 prison inmates, I'm not kidding, Audrey, I'm not kidding, wrongly received more than $9 million in tax credits for home buyers despite being locked up when they claimed they bought a home, the government investigator reported Wednesday. The investigator said 241 of the inmates were serving life sentences. Well, maybe they thought, they'd have a second life, and when they got out, they'd have a house. But anyway, in all, more than 14,000 taxpayers wrongly received $26.7 million in tax credits that were meant to boost the nation's slumping housing market. This is very troubling, says says George, Congress created and modified the home buyer credit to stimulate the economy and help taxpayers achieve the American dream, but not the line the pockets of wrongdoers. Just absolutely incredible. The prison inmates, the very small number of payments were made to prisoners incorrectly, which the IRS is now taking steps on all sides to recapture these funds that went to the prisoners. But what more can we do? You know, I don't have the story in this, but I heard this secondhand from a radio broadcaster, newscaster today, that the Labor Department is going to employ 250 investigators to fan out across the United States. I mean, this is the night when you need a seatbelt for your chair for the news. 250 investigators to go around the states, the United States, and make sure that illegal immigrants get the minimum wage. I'm not kidding. To make sure that illegal immigrants get the minimum wage. Illegal immigrants means they're not supposed to be here to start with, and if somebody hires them at below the minimum wage, then that person will be prosecuted and the minimum wage feature will be corrected. I mean, the deficit will be corrected for these people. I love the government and the way they take care of people, but isn't that interesting? Fremont, Nebraska went ahead and did it. I guess you probably read about that story. Fremont passed the law that says you can't live there in the city, you can't be a renter, or you cannot be a rentee, someone that's looking to have to go get a permit to get a house and rent a house or an apartment, and it's a misdemeanor crime in that city. Here, let me give you some details on that one, too. I'm doing this one from memory, but the small Nebraska town, the meatpacking town, joined Arizona at the center of this national debate after voters approved a ban on hiring or renting property to illegal immigrants. But an expected court challenge could keep the measure from ever taking effect. The ACLU, don't you love them, they're always there, have promised to file a lawsuit to block the enforcement of the proposal. So Fremont, of course, will have to defend this. We've had a couple other cities do very similar things. I recall it was like Hazleton, Pennsylvania here a while back. And Farmers Branch, Texas did the same thing. And they lost their battle in court, but they're appealing it. So those cases are not resolved. But on the issue of illegal immigration, it takes some courage of residents. Others may call it something else if they're looking at it from a different perspective. But it takes some courage to stand up and pass a law like this. And the city did. And we'll have to see what happens in that town here in the future relative to court suits and that type of business. Mike, what's happening? We got our computer screens jumping all over the place. Well, they settled down a little bit now. Thank you. This is a good one I like. Police have used decoys for a long time. I don't know if folks not inside the police game or law enforcement would understand the term jackroller, but a jackroller is somebody that goes out and finds the drunks and the homeless on the street that might have money on them, like, you know, after the first of the month when they happen to get a check from the government or something. They get out and get drunk and they pass out. Well, jackrollers come along and get them. Well, cities in Florida years ago used decoys to stop that. In other words, the cops would dress up like the homeless and be passed out drunk, and they have, like, money sticking out of their pocket or something like that, and then these creeps would come down the alley and steal money from them, and then of course the cops would get up and call two other cops that were on stakeout there, and they would arrest these people. Well, listen to what's going on in Holland, in Amsterdam. The Dutch police are using decoy Jews to stop anti-Semitic attacks. Apparently, there's been an increase in a substantial rash of attacks on those dressed in Jewish religious dress, such as skull caps, that type of business. So what the Dutch police are doing, they're dressing up as if they were Jews in Amsterdam, six Amsterdam neighborhoods that are heavily Jewish. And it's working. They're catching people. They also have decoy prostitutes, decoy gays, and decoy grannies who go out and work on the street. one of the police officials said, if we receive several reports of street robbery in a certain location, we send out the granny. And things seemed to quiet down after a while. Not the granny would be a female, of course, but years ago when we used to use cops, when there weren't a lot of women officers, they used male cops to dress like women on the street and see if they could get the Johns to solicit them. And the guys that did that were very good guys and manly for sure, but they took a razzing in the police locker room because they dressed up like women. But isn't that incredible that this is going on to that degree in Holland, that they have to do this? Here's one again that will knock you off your seat. People are thinking that President Obama, and they think the senators have written a letter to them and congressmen because they've heard that this is true. They're discussing a one fell swoop amnesty granted by the President of the United States to the 11 to 18 million illegal immigrants in the United States. Now, wouldn't that be incredible? I don't know how a president could step forward with that type of audacity and disrespect for the legislative process and do something like that. Of course, presidents can grant amnesty in all kinds of situations, but what are you betting on that will happen? I don't see how it could. It certainly couldn't happen, but we'll see what happens. I got two more news stories. This one in California. Only in California could something happen like this. But California is considering this. California is who knows how many billions of dollars in debt they are today, but it's serious. But so what they're going to do to make up for the money, they have proposed, they've worked it out, and they've checked it. They are going to have digital license plates for the cars. In other words, if you get out and get your plate, it's going to have your, you'll have your number on it in letters, just like it would be, BKU1212 or something like that. But when your car is stopped, like at a red light or a stop sign, and if it's stopped for more than 4 seconds, the license plate will turn into a digital billboard, and it will be advertising products, theaters, movies, television shows, L.A. Law, or something like that. In other words, they're selling that space to food manufacturers, manufacturing, entertainers, whatever. They're selling your license plate space. Now, I can see this causing a few problems, right? You stop 4 seconds, and maybe you stop the light for, 20 seconds. The light changes, and somebody's there staring at your license plate trying to get the whole story of the ad. And for the cop, what's the cop have to do? Wait till you start moving before she or he can see the license plate? I mean, is that about as bizarre as you can ever see? Well, if you think that's nuts, hold on to this one. In the United States now, all over law schools, in order to make their graduates more marketable, they are, in fact, raising the grades of law students who graduated, a year or two ago or last year. They're going back and going into courses that are already completed where they've been issued a grade, and they're going to raise their grade to a higher level so that their overall average, their graduating average, will be higher and they'll be more marketable. In other words, people that hire them will think they're more smart than they really are. Of course, you could argue about grades, for the next century, actually, the rationale and philosophy of what's the right way to grade and that type of thing. But isn't that absolutely incredible that law schools would be doing something like that? So be careful. The lawyer that you get may not be as smart as you think she or he is. Well, that's enough for the news tonight. We're going to shift over to our story about legal and illegal immigration. And this is a fantastic story, a very interesting book. And we're going to use this off of Book TV one more time. But this is Mark Kerkorian. Mark, he's the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. He's a grandson of Armenian immigrants to the United States, and he's often a contributor to the National Review and the National Review Online, which is, as you probably realize, is a conservative source. But he's going to talk to us about the case that he has made in this book, why we should not only stop illegal immigration, but why we should stop illegal immigration also. The feature, the book goes, the book presentation goes on longer than we have, but that's been the case with most of these when we've used Book TV. But again, I would encourage you to go to booktv.org, booktv.org. If you haven't done it, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books on there, thousands actually, where you can see the author, see and hear the author present their book to an audience at a university, a bookstore, or some other type of gathering. You've probably heard my joke about that. You know, being inside the university business and taught a lot of different places, you know, I always thought that faculty ought to be reading books and trying to stay up on their field. Well, now, even if they don't read books, they can act like they do. they can go to TV and get a half hour, 45-minute blurb on a book that will normally take hours for them to read. I'm kidding a little bit, but you get my point. So here we go with Mark Krikorian. He's the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. He's going to talk to us about his book on illegal, the new case amnesty. What's the actual thing of it called? The new case against immigration. I'm sorry. The new case against immigration, both legal and illegal. Michael, I wish the screen would stop jumping, jumping up and down. It covers up stuff. Okay, here we go. I hope you enjoy this. We'll stop in about 5 minutes still, as we usually do.
All immigration, both legal and illegal, by Mark Krikorian, author of The New Case Against Immigration. He appears at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Program is 90 minutes. Welcome all. Welcome to the American Enterprise Institute and important discussion we're going to have today with Mark Krikorian, author of The New Case Against Immigration. I am David Fromm. I'm a resident fellow here at the American Enterprise Institute, and I will be moderating today. I will introduce the panel in just a moment. Let me say a few words to preface. Immigration is, of course, one of the most contentious issues in American society. We see many debates about it on cable news, on the radio, talk radio, and magazines and op-ed pages. And not always does this discussion lead either to greater enlightenment or even to the possibility of some kind of consensus and effective public policy. In this world of very emotional argument, Mark Krikorian and the Center for Immigration Studies really stand out. I noticed that there are some other associates of the Center for Immigration Studies here. I'd like to signal Steve Camerata, who's a great producer of facts and figures and hard data on the immigration question, and all of us who work in this area are very indebted to him and to the Center. Mark's book is a very powerful statement that applies techniques of social science to this contentious area in the hope of leading us to better understanding and thus to better policy and thus to better outcomes for all American people. Our format today is Mark will speak first, and then we'll have two commentators, and let me do a brief introduction. Mark Krikorian is, of course, the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies and the author of this new book, The New Case Against Immigration. Speaking second will be Fred Siegel, who is a polymathic expert on American urban issues. He is a professor at the Cooper Union and a contributing editor to the Manhattan Institute City Journal. Between Mark and Fred is Jason Richwine, who is a PhD student at the Kennedy School of Government and who is here with us at the American Enterprise Institute as a National Research Initiative fellow, and we are very grateful to them for underwriting his important work on immigration and IQ. Mark will speak first, then Professor Siegel, then Jason Richwine, and then we'll move to your questions and open this up to a general discussion. Mark, the floor is yours.
Thank you, David, and thanks to AEI for generously hosting this event. I'm just going to give a quick overview of the points of the book. It's available for sale outside. I'll be happy to sign them afterwards. I've actually practiced what I'll write in there, this being my first book. As David said, there's a lot of discussion of the immigration issue. A lot of it involves more heat than light, but even the parts that have some light rather than heat focus mainly on the issue of illegality. How do we enforce the law? What do we do about illegal immigrants here, et cetera? These are important questions. But the implicit assumption, and for some people the explicit assumption, is that very high levels of legal immigration would be okay, that the illegality is the problem that we face here. And the case I try to make in my book is that the answer is no, that the issue, the problems we face with regard to immigration today don't just focus on illegality, though obviously that's the most pressing and immediate concern. Rather, the problem is a larger one, that high levels of immigration are incompatible with the goals and characteristics of modern society. And the problem here is not that the immigrants are different from the past, that the immigrants have somehow changed the immigration flow, that it's somehow dramatically less skilled or not from Europe or some other way different from previous immigration flows that were somehow better. Rather, we have changed. The changes in American society over the past century, economic, social changes, governmental, technological, etc., have resulted in the kind of social change that results in what modernization, modernity, that makes immigration a significant problem in a way that simply wasn't true in the past. Immigration was very contentious in the past. We sort of forget that, but we made it work. And what we're experiencing now is a similar immigration flow into a very different country. In a word, mass immigration was a phase, like settlements of the frontier by pioneers, but a phase that shaped us and that we have now outgrown. And let me touch on a few of the areas and a few of the sort of conflict incompatibility between mass immigration and modern society. First, in economics. We are importing 19th century workers into a 21st century high-tech economy. And the problem here is there's no moral fault. The immigrants aren't somehow defective or anything else. They're really not that similar. Not that different, rather, from the immigrants of the past, but we've changed. And the result is that we are artificially flooding a low-skilled labor market. And this has a number of serious consequences. In a post-industrial economy like ours, in one that's changed fundamentally from anything that existed in the past, this artificial flooding of the low-skilled labor market is reducing the wages of low-skilled Americans, of that portion of the American workforce that, for whatever reason, ability or inclination or others, is not able to succeed in the same way that those of us here are in, symbol manipulation jobs, as they say. It's harming their wages. It's crowding them out of the labor market. I didn't actually believe that was the case, but new research is, in fact, showing that certain groups of American workers that are most directly in competition with low-skilled immigrants, teenagers, young adult workers, low-skilled native-born Hispanic and black workers, are in fact seeing their employment rates decrease. They're being crowded out of the labor market. With regard to welfare policy or government spending and government services overall, a century ago, all levels of government consumed something like 5% of GDP. Today, all levels of government combined consume more than one-third of GDP. This isn't just welfare, this is schools, hospitals, roads, all the things that government now spends money on, uses tax receipts and spends money on that didn't in the past. And Milton Friedman pretty much summed up the quandary here. It's just obvious you can't have open immigration and a welfare state. And again, this isn't a defect on the part of the immigrant. Nobody in Michoal Khan is saying, boy, I want to come to America and get me some of that ASPC. Rather, they're immigrants who are coming here and, despite how hard they work, end up on being supported and subsidized by taxpayers. For instance, the majority of families headed by Mexican immigrants, more than half, receive at least one major form of welfare. This is not, again, because of an unwillingness to work. This is because when you import 19th century workers into a 21st century society, it doesn't matter how many jobs you work and how hard you work. You cannot support your family without being subsidized by the taxpayer. On assimilation, this is an area where there's a lot of misunderstanding of the effects of immigration, but the conflict between modern conditions and mass immigration is very serious here, and it's in two ways. Modern technology makes transnational lives possible. In other words, cheap telephone calls, the internet, cheap airfare, makes it possible for an immigrant to not really lose touch with the old country. This is not an issue of a greater or lesser willingness to become American. I often hear from people sympathetic to my point of view that my grandpa from Odessa wanted to become an American, and what's wrong with these darn immigrants today? Nothing. The fact is that today's immigrants don't really have to lose touch with the old country. It's perfectly natural for an immigrant to want to maintain ties with his home country. There's a New Yorker cartoon that really sticks in my mind of an old man, an immigrant, talking to his grandchildren at New York Harbor and saying, the country that grandpa came from was a miserable hellhole where everybody was always happy. I mean, at the end of Fiddler on the Roof, they're singing Anna Tevka, which is this sort of bittersweet song. They're glad to leave in some sense because to get away from the Cossacks. On the other hand, it was their place. So it's natural for people to want to keep a tie. But what happened without modern technology is that they lost those ties, and the natural process of atrophying those connections and switching their emotional allegiance to their new home was, in a sense, sort of forced on them. It isn't today. The second development in modern society that makes assimilation difficult, problematic, is that elites lose much of the self-confidence, the cultural self-confidence that's necessary to demand newcomers comply and conform with your ways rather than the other way around. And this manifests itself as multiculturalism, bilingualism, what have you. And the supporters of high levels of immigration are right in that this is not something these immigrants have brought with them or imposed on us. A Wall Street Journal writer who wrote a book, sort of the diametrical opposite of mine, just recently, said, keep the immigrants, deport the Columbia faculty. Well, as appealing a prospect as that might be in some sense, certainly the second part of it, the fact remains that multiculturalism and this broader lack of cultural self-confidence is not some superficial phenomenon.
Next, an argument against all immigration, both legal and illegal. Go is
that. I'm on the mission to create the sea within which the terrorists fish. Immigrant parents are doing the same thing today in the L.A. Unified School District and the New York City Public Schools. They're saying, we don't know what it is to be. Unwillingness to work, this is because when you import 19th century workers into a 21st century society, it doesn't matter. That is the security challenge, is undeniable. And it's not a narrow issue of radical Islam, because the fact, because of modern technology, all future conflicts, forever, that we face, whether it's with China or the Taiwan Strait, North Korea, if the Colombian state fails and we get sucked into a war, whatever it is, the threat to the home front is ever present and is always going to be there because of modern conditions. And mass immigration undermines our efforts to security in this modern environment in two big ways. First of all, it overwhelms our ability to screen out the people we want to screen out. A century ago, there were still bad guys who wanted to come here. There were anarchists. There were wobblies, which I consider bad guys anyway. There were other problem people that we wanted to screen out. But because of primitive technology, making mistakes wasn't all that big a danger. There wasn't a way to coordinate assaults against America globally. It was very difficult. Were you going to send a letter and wait for 2 months for it to cross the Atlantic? It just wasn't feasible. Also, what could a guy in a horse-drawn wagon with dynamite in the back do to blow up a wooden frame building? I mean, yeah, there was actually some degree of terrorism in the past, in earlier immigration waves, but it was not even remotely comparable and consequential to what we face today. So screening out bad guys matters. And the Immigration Service today is choking on immigration. It is utterly incapable of screening out the people we want to screen out, and it's not because of stupid and lazy bureaucrats. I'm sure there's plenty of those. As GM's got a lot of them too. But the fact is that however effective, however efficient, however well well provisioned and resourced our immigration services, when they have to screen well over a million legal immigrants a year, hundreds of thousands of long-term non-immigrants a year, they can't do the job very effectively. And you end up with the kind of situations we've seen where bad guys use our immigration system to every aspect of our immigration system to get into the country and to implant themselves here. The second aspect, the second conflict between security and mass immigration is that high levels of immigration inevitably create what Mao would have described as fish within which the terrorist fish. High levels of immigration create the sea within which the terrorist fish swim. Large, unassimilated immigrant communities. President Bush, early on in this war, said Al-Qaeda's terrorism as the mafia is the crime. And that's an apt analogy. And the way we overcame the mafia, quite frankly, is to some degree, or at least initially creating the conditions, was to stop immigration, allow assimilation, end the old country norms of omerta over a period of a generation or so. And what we're doing with immigration is creating new incubators and covers where immigrants unintentionally, not through any planning, serve as cover for terrorists. And so let me just wrap up by saying, so what should we do? And this is an answer that you often don't get from most people. I did a whole publication years ago on saying, what is your ideal immigration policy? And I asked people on all sides of the debate, and I got lots of op-eds rather than actual details, lots of op-eds without any specifics. Without going into a lot of detail, what we need is not zero immigration, but zero-based budgeting immigration. Start at zero, and then determine which groups of people are so compelling to admit that we are willing to take on whatever problems immigration creates. And that would involves husbands, wives, and little kids of American citizens who've never been barred even in the 20s. One of my grandmothers came in after the shutoff because she married my grandfather. A handful of Einsteins, real Einsteins, not the B-plus students from Hyderabad Community College that we now take. And third, some number, which is a subjective number we determine politically, of the most desperate people in the world who don't have anywhere else to go and will never have anywhere else to go no matter what. There's a lot of people like that, and we're not taking them through our refugee program. That would still end up being 350 to 400,000 people a year. It's not ending immigration, but it is, in fact, dramatically reducing it and ending immigration for its own sake rather than determining very specific interests that would permit the immigration of discrete groups of people. Let me stop there, and I'd love to hear what my discussants have to say.
Mark, thank you so much. And I will now turn the talk stick over to Fred Siegel.
Well, I make the point that the discontinuity Mark is laying out is not entirely accurate. What I mean by that is this. The welfare state, the modern welfare state, is in part created in response to the globalization and mass immigration of a century ago. In other words, this process is continuous. The growth of the national state from before World War I, years between 1900 and 1950, are in part a function of the way globalization creates far greater economic insecurity, and the way immigration transforms political life in a way that people found unsettling. Much of the progressive movement is a response, in a sense, to mass immigration. So my only point here is that there's a continuity with what Mark is saying. It's not just that the welfare state we now have is problematic for immigration. If immigration helps produce, mass immigration helps produce the welfare state in the first place. So these things are integrally tied.
I don't get how a statement different from that, actually.
Acculturation. I live in Brooklyn, a part of Flatbush that looks like it's furious. Large Victorian houses, two-car garages, front porches. That's one section of the neighborhood. Overall, it's the most diverse census tract in the United States. It's also the census tract that held three of the 9/11 bombers, a few blocks from where I live. To make Mark's point about terror and the sea of immigrants. But leaving terrorism aside, what you see in this small neighborhood is stratified acculturation. What I mean by that is second generation Latino kids learning to be tough without the work ethic of their parents, hanging out on the corners at night, pretending they're hip hop characters. I don't even know the language, I just know the gestures. You know, avoid this bodega. This is something new that you didn't have in the earlier immigration. It was true to some degree, but not to the extent we have now. One thing I always get a big kick out of is if I go to the Arab American areas of Brooklyn, I have guys who think they're gangsters. They dress and talk and act exactly like African American hoods. So you've got this problem of stratified acculturation, which is going to create enormous troubles down the road. And the reason for that is what I call a second-generation problem. And the reason the second-generation problem is so important is something I think Mark doesn't emphasize enough in the book. You know, I'm in broad agreement with the book. And that is the complete, and I do mean complete collapse of the educational system. I'll give you an example of what I mean. It sounds like hyperbole. My college, Cooper Union, admits kids in the top 1.5% of all high school graduates. 1.5%. They're all double 700. Granted, SATs have been watered down. Not a single one of my kids know what a grand jury is. Zero. African-American neighbor talks about school on our corner, school one of my kids went to. Says the school does exactly two things. Prepares kids to take tests. There's a lot of gaming of the tests, outright cheating. They're giving the answers sometimes, and they build PCs. And beyond that, you can't figure out what's going on in the school. This collapse is profound. This is the primary mechanism of Americanization. And it is collapse. I'll give you one other example so you don't think I'm engaging in hyperbole. And by the way, it's what I'm saying is true in France and England as well. I'm giving a lecture on the Lincoln-Douglas debate. I asked my student, I said, you have to understand the peculiar geography of Illinois. It stretches from Lake Michigan to Kentucky. You can see the glazed look. Where is Illinois? A few people said it's next to Pennsylvania. A few people said it's in the Midwest. A few said it's near Chicago. Most of the kids had absolutely no idea. Labor glut. We're in the midst of a worldwide labor glut. So if I'm a lower middle class worker, immigrant, and we have an enormous investment in immigrants who are already here, which will be undermined by further flows. You can see in California, each wave. Years ago, I did a book partly on Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C. And what I saw in Los Angeles Harbor is how each new wave of immigration undercut the brother and brother running the trucking company at Los Angeles Harbor. These guys came in offering less and less and less. And real wages after niches. They work in niches. And I see it again in my neighborhood, where Mexican-American gardeners are constantly undercutting the guy who came 2 months before. They come by, I'll do it for $20 less. I'll do it for $40 less. Well, that's fine for me, but it's not good. It's not good for their future. And this is, I think, politically is the most important question. Under conditions of what I would call gentry liberalism, and that's what you're going to see in the Obama administration, gentry liberalism. Mass immigration creates a servant class with serious distributional effects. What do I mean by that? I mean that if I'm upper middle class in New York City, I have people take care of my children, clean my apartment or house, prepare inexpensive meals for me, and perform all sorts of other sundry services at extraordinarily low prices. It's a collective servant class. And because you have these other two problems I mentioned, the problem of the second generation, downward mobility in the second generation, the collapse of the educational system, these kids are being trapped. And you see this in one particular population in New York, the Dominican population, tremendous downward mobility. One other point.
Well, I think Professor Siegel makes some good points there also. Sounds like he's getting some of the best students you can get in the country, and he says they can't tell you where Illinois is or some other rather basic things. We've kind of gotten away from the idea that facts and knowing facts are sort of meaningless. Everything has to be directed towards some type of objective that transfers into some workplace type of performance of skills. Well, anyway, it's a very complicated long story, but it's a different approach, isn't it? Mark Krikorian's book, it's called The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal, and I think he makes some solid points that you don't generally hear in the media or even in some of the public radio on some of those things like that, because it takes a long time to explain them. But when you take the key points of his book all together, and you can hear the whole discussion here, it takes about an hour and 20 minutes or hour and 30 minutes, you can get a better idea of that, or you could do that really crazy thing nowadays, and you could go out and buy Mark Krikorian's book. I think I'm going to get this one and read it myself and ponder what it said. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Switch back on in a week or so and see what we're going to be doing. And don't forget to join us in July when we have a very special guest on to talk about illegal immigration. So away we go here, and we'll sign off like we always do with Vera Lynn.
telling us we'll meet again. Vera, join us. Who says you can't have four browsers open at the same time? Different ones I made. All right, here we go. Good night, folks.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.